you getting to sing with me in my hometown is my birthday gift to you. Because I'm cheap and I forgot.
That is one of Kansas City's most famous native sons, actor and comedian Jason Sudeikis. He's talking to fellow Saturday Night Live alum Will Forte. They're on stage getting ready to do karaoke, which we will hear in a second. Jason Sudeikis comes to town kind of a lot to put on big events, fundraisers for charitable causes, usually ones championed by his relatives and childhood friends. And typically, he brings a star-studded cast of friends along with him. So this is what happened at one of those events here in town on Will Forte's birthday back in 2016.
I can't fight this feeling any longer. Yet I'm still afraid to let it flow. What started out as friendship has grown stronger. I only wish I had the strength to let it show. I tell myself that I can't hold out forever. I said there is no reason for my fear. 'Cause I feel so secure when we're together. You give my life direction. You make everything so clear.
You can watch this on YouTube. People behind them, celebrities like Eric Stone Street, are starting to slowly stand up and embrace each other in the pose of awkward eighth grade slow dances everywhere. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and Jason Sudeikis is back in town for Thundergong. That's tomorrow night. He is in the studio now, and hello, Jason. I let that go on for a long time, but I just love it.
I'm flattered that that Will still sings with me after me sliding into that first note of mine. But, yeah.
Is that your go-to karaoke song?
I don't know. That was one that we started singing at some point. I forget how, I forget why, and then where the idea to make it like get really mean and angry and like, you know, plaintive during the chorus. I forget where that all came from, but I have a few go-to karaoke songs, you know. My go-to is just karaoke in general.
So this event was the Big Slick. That was a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And then this time you're here with your lifelong friend, Billy Brimblecom Jr., who we're going to talk to shortly. But he has inspired you to put on another big event. And I'm curious, so this thing is called Thundergong. What exactly is it and why is it called that?
Boy, I mean, you know, you've invoked his name. We're looking at him. He would know better than me. But Thundergong, I don't know where the name comes from. I don't even know if it's a real instrument. Is it?
Oh, no.
No. Okay. Not yet, at least. Yeah. But yeah, origin, I've got nothing for you. What was the other chunk?
I can answer that.
Well, what's happening? So,
oh, yeah.
But the name, tell me more about the name, Billy.
It.
And also, hello.
Hi. Hey, everybody. The name is, it's pretty nonsensical. Thundergong was originally going to be a drummer event. So yeah. I had this idea that Jason and I have been talking about ever since Steps of Faith started 5 years ago. We talked about trying to do some sort of event together that would be whatever we wanted, is what I told him. When the time is right for you, it'll be whatever we want. Mm-hmm. So we were going to have a house band and we were going to have all these guest drummers. Jason is lucky to his best drummer friends other than me are guys like Dave Grohl from Foo Fighters. So it was like, this would be this amazing thing. So originally,
and you imagine just drumming.
Well, I, but kind of, but we would be doing these, having these famous guest drummers, but we doing these songs. Ultimately, the vision was blurry, and it cleared up when the event happened. Right? There would be we'd get Grohl. He'll play drums, but then also maybe then he'll sing. Right? And so, nonetheless, we were trying to come up with a percussive title, and then my good buddy Micah Smith, who did all of the branding for Steps of Faith, the logo, and the Thundergong logo.
And Steps of Faith, we'll explain that in a second.
Yep.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Basically, I had this huge list of all these words and on in two columns, and I had one column had gong and one had thunder, and it was going to be Gongs of Thunder.
And then
he was like, okay, that's it. We're going to do it, Gongs of Thunder. And then like a week later, he was like, I've got the logo ready, and it's called Thundergong. And I was like, man, okay. And then he showed it to me, and it was like we were all around like a board table, and everybody went, oh, it's Thundergong, the power of good branding. So, yeah.
There you go.
Well, so, okay, what's going to be happening at this event, you guys? And then we'll get into the story behind it.
Yeah, so, I mean, the event is just a straight up a concert. You know, there's no tables with numbers on them, and there's no, you know, paddles to be raised. You don't have to wear a tuxedo.
Tuxedo t-shirt could be
Yeah,
cool,
please. Though. Yeah, yeah. I'll go, you know, if you want to go informally formal, please. But yeah, it is a 3-hour concert, eclectic, all over the place, with a great house band, a bunch of wonderful local musicians, and then we just rotate, you know, the singers and the genre of music. And
some highlights. I mean, there's Chance the Rapper.
Yeah, Chance the Rapper's coming in. Ben Harper. Those are two people that people know from, you know, the world of music, but then also myself, and then Forte's coming back, and our buddy Sam Richardson from Veep and Detroiters is coming in town. We got Rob Zabrecki, who's an amazing artist, doing magic for us, singing a song. He's a you know, world renowned magician and friend and former rock star himself.
So this is a giant event, is basically the summary here. And
yeah,
so, you're
yeah.
doing this for your friend.
Well, I'm doing. We're doing. He and I are both doing it together for people that we don't really know yet.
Yeah,
truthfully, you know.
Yeah. So explain that, yeah. Billy. This, I mean, your story is kind of what inspired this. So can you talk about your foundation and why it exists? It happened. It's because of something in your life.
Yeah, sure. So in 2005, I was diagnosed with a form of cancer called Ewing's sarcoma. And what that basically translated to was I had a giant killer tumor in my left ankle. And as a result, my left leg was amputated above the knee, right above the knee. But it all got better. I beat the cancer. That got the cancer. I even got the girl and limped off into the sunset. So, so then I was a professional musician at the time, a drummer. And fortunately, through the grace of God and great doctors and a wonderful prosthetist, I was able to get back on my feet and get rolling. You know, I don't feel really identify as a handicapped person very often, even though I clearly am one. And that's just because I don't feel like one, because I've got the right tools with this great prosthetic leg. So fast forward to in 2006, Jason and some great friends, Corey Rittmaster, Monique Madrid, Kay Cannon, and Ed Goodman, put on a comedy show, and my band Blackpool Lights played, and the Architects played, and we raised a bunch of money because my insurance would only cover half of what I needed for a prosthetic leg. We had raised $30,000 for a $60,000 leg in 2006. So that happened. That was incredible. The next day in 2006, back then, I told my girlfriend, now wife, wouldn't it be cool if we did that again in a year for somebody else? Well, that didn't happen. We moved to Nashville. We were there 7 years. And while I was there, really this kind of fell in my lap. We had a brand new baby, and I was looking for work that was not touring musician work on the road so that I could be home with my new family. And I met the gentleman who owned the prosthetic place where I was a patient, in short, named Rob Pittman. And after they had me talk to a new patient that had lost his leg and was on the other side of this, I was on the other side of it than him. And I said, I'd love to talk to this guy. That'd be great. And then I just left that talk with that guy saying, I wish that could be my job. And then I met Rob, and then he said, well, maybe it could be. I've been trying to get a nonprofit off the ground for 4 years. I've got 501c3 status. We're going to help amputees that have no insurance, so we don't have to turn them away, so people can get back to work. They can get back to using all four limbs. They can get out of the wheelchair, get off the walker, all of that stuff. You want to try to make this happen? That was it.
Wow. That must have been really that must have been really invigorating after this period where you had wanted to do something like that just on your own, to be invited to do it on a larger scale like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's no coincidence. You know, I mean, it really was like, you know, among the greatest blessings of my life. It just kind of fell into my lap out of the sky. And so, and it also kind of felt like just like the answer to years of questions. And I also, I've since told Rob this, we were both far less equipped to do this at the beginning than we thought we were. I was like, oh, this makes sense. This is perfect. And I was, and it was right. But I just basically, once that happened, I pretty much just reached out to everybody I knew, Jason included, and said, check out what just happened to me. Because in the story of my life, it's a pretty cool part of the story, right? But what that did was $20 to a lot more than $20, little by little, reaching out to everybody I knew, that created the initial donor base that basically sustained us for years.
So, and explain exactly what it is that the nonprofit does.
Yeah. So Steps of Faith Foundation is a nonprofit public charity, 501c3. We're based in Kansas City, and we help amputees nationwide when they have no health insurance or no prosthetic coverage with their health insurance and no other way to pay for a prosthetic limb. Oftentimes, that doesn't mean you're poor, right? I use my dad as an example all the time. My dad's one of the most hardest working people I've ever met, and is a real example of that. And for the longest time, it was more affordable for my dad to pay the penalty than to have health insurance. Okay, well, if somebody like my dad, thank God this hasn't happened, lost a limb, this is the situation all the time. This is your neighbor. It's not like, hey man, we got to make sure we have our wedding ring insured, and we've got all this planning for, we got to make sure we've got an amputee plan. Like, you don't plan for that kind of thing. I didn't, when I was 28, go, man, I better be ready if I get cancer and lose my leg, you know? So, you know, back to the example of my dad, it's just your neighbor. It's the everyday person who just doesn't have health insurance. Then they get sidelined with this, you know, disease, accident, injury, illness, whatever the case may be. And it's like, well, now what? Like, as if emotionally it wasn't hard enough to deal with the fact that you've lost a body part, right? You've lost a limb. Oh, then I have to come up with like $10,000 to $100,000 just to buy this tool to help me walk. It's crazy.
It is crazy. And so, Jason, can you take me back to the moment where you hear from your friend about this new phase in his life where he's going to, well, first of all, where you hear from your friend that he's going to be losing his leg? I mean, that you guys have been friends, what, going back to childhood, right?
Late childhood. I mean, yeah, since what, 95, I guess.
1995.
Yeah, so we're 18 and 19 years old. So, yeah, that's childhood, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a heavy duty thing. You know, what can I tell you about it? Going back to that moment, it's hope and you know, you try to be as strong as you can for your friend, and I think there's times in my life where I've faltered there. You know, having a friend that Billy that's battled this, my own mother, you know, beating breast cancer. Like, you know, I'm not alone in being side by side with someone that's gone through, you know, and pushed through, and maybe even fallen to that horrible disease. But but yeah, at some point you're kind of like, okay, how do we help? What do we do? What do we do next? How do we, you know, march on? How do we continue on? And
a lot of people like to imagine, I think, that celebrities are immune to these kinds of things, which is absurd, but true.
Yeah. I mean, I think there probably are, but there are probably, you know, teachers that are immune to it and accountants that are immune to it and whatnot. But yeah, no, I mean, these are real things. These are real things that happen to real people. And I would say, having known a few celebrities in my time, that there are, yeah, real people too. you know, at least the ones I try to roll with. But it really kind of takes your breath away, and you sort of face with a mortality of someone, you know, the same age as you is a baffling thing. And there's no normal way to react to that abnormal situation. So we had to, you know, come about it from a different perspective. And that was, you know, how do we raise money for someone so near and dear to me? And then it doesn't surprise me, again, having known Billy that long, that the second, you know, that light was shown upon him, how can he turn himself into a disco ball to, you know, have that blast of light, you know, split into 1,000 pieces and spin around a room that make people feel good. And that's, you know, Steps of Faith Foundation, and then by proxy, Thunder Garden is a practical example of of that sort of philosophy that he lives with, whether he realizes it or not.
Well, the disco ball analogy is funny because I recently discovered, Billy, that you actually got into yacht rock as one of your recent genres.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yacht rock, like yacht as in a big...
So yacht rock is like a made up music genre that is now I think beginning to be accepted as a real thing.
Yeah, I mean they've got a serious XM radio station, so like, that's legit,
yeah. and that's only helped us. Yeah, many years ago actually, in early 2000s, a great friend of mine, Bill Pyle. We would do DJ nights together where we would just play like vinyl records like Journey and the Beastie Boys and Mr.
Maybe
like,
some REO Speedwagon.
Oh, you bet. Oh, yeah. You bet your bippy we would do that. And so Bill gave me a mix CD around that time, probably around 2003, that he had made. And it was called Slow Jams for Soccer Moms. And on that mix CD, I know for a fact there was, I think, that REO Speedwagon song. Mm-hmm. And there was like Ambrosia and Christopher Cross and the Doobie Brothers and all of these things that then later was dubbed by some people as yacht rock. So it's mid-70s to mid-80s soft rock, which is basically the stuff that was on the radio when I was a little kid, you know. You know, songs about like pina coladas and boats and, you know, Sailing by Christopher Cross is a perfect
example.
Sung by
people with unbuttoned short sleeve shirts.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. With some Hawaiian prints.
Simpler times.
Like simpler times. So that, yeah, basically, several years later, I was on a road trip with my wife, and we were listening to a yacht rock mix that Bill had made me, the Slow Jams for Soccer Mom mix, and I said, wouldn't it be crazy if we put a band together to play these songs? And she was like, yeah, that'd be crazy. These songs are so hard. It's like all these like beds of harmonies and these R&B slow jam rhythm sections. It's nuts. Long story short, we did it, and in April, it'll be 10 years, and we're still doing it. And
Summer Breeze.
Summer Breeze.
That's
a tribute to
band.
Yacht rock. Yeah. Summer Breeze. So that has actually been, you know, I've been lucky enough in playing music to kind of go, you know, other places in the world and do some things and live some dreams. And that's really, really great. But I seriously think one of the things that's been the most fun and definitely received the most attention is this yacht rock band, is Summer Breeze. But it's a beautiful thing. My wife's in the band with me. Jason's performed with us many times at our shows. And it's, you know, some of my oldest friends. And it's a fun deal. And we're the house band.
And they kick butt. Like the tunes are great. But if you don't do the tunes well, like it's kitschy. But they actually, they kick ass, like, and they, you know, the harmonies, the musicianship, all that, you know, Billy wears a captain hat. I mean, they go for it. It's such a fun night, and it's always a fun thing to watch and be a part of. So then, yeah, it was a no brainer to have them be the house band because they can literally play anything.
Well, so Jason, you know, I interviewed you many, many years ago when you were in town to support your mom's work for Gilda's Club, which supports people with cancer and their families as they're dealing with any number of issues. And now you're here bringing like a crazy celebrity lineup full of big time performers in support of your friend's nonprofit to help amputees. You just really bring it for your friends and family in Kansas City.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is, you know, I've been really lucky in many, many ways, and with my work, my career, to give me a platform that allows for a great opportunity to throw a hand down whenever possible to pull someone up. You know, you attempt not to let them tug on the rope and pull you down, but you know, it can happen on occasion, but it hasn't in a while. Knock on whatever this material is. But
there's wood in there somewhere.
But
I
yeah,
would love
I mean,
a wood desk,
for me,
that's
you
not
know,
what we have.
Yeah, right. For me, yeah, it's much easier to support those around me sometimes than supporting myself. And you know, just that's just the way I'm wired. But yeah, I'm very lucky to have people willing to rise to the call as well.
You know, I read in a Rolling Stone article that they call it your egalitarian appeal, but they said that it relates to your Kansas upbringing, and I wonder if you agree with that.
What does egalitarian mean?
I think it means that everybody likes you.
Oh, that's not true, but that's nice. I was trying to define it. I think it's also partly egalitarian,
but I also think that it has to do with that you typically kind of play, you play a lot of everyman type characters.
Sure. Yeah. No, I feel very much like an everyman. I think that is defined probably by where I come from. You know, being raised in a place that that got things on their second wave. You know, I was lucky to have family in Chicago, which is a little bit bigger than this, so they'd hear about things. We had family out in L.A. And so, you know, things a lot of times ripple in, at least trends, and, you know, whether in any form of fashion or art, sort of, you know, fold in from the coasts into the middle, and we get things last. But lucky to grow up in a time pre-internet that had MTV and all that. So I've just, I would say that... I'm kind of lost my train of thought there, other than thinking about MTV in the good old days. But
your upbringing,
yeah, just the upbringing, yeah. That I'm, shoot, I don't know. Like I can't speak about myself and outside of myself.
Okay, well, I'm gonna give you an example, and this is kind of a weird example, but like, okay, there's something that we don't have time to play, but there was this sketch on Saturday Night Live where you were playing a lawyer defending someone on trial for murder.
Great.
And the basis of your defense was that he had been sending embarrassing text messages throughout the time when the murder was committed.
Yep.
And your delivery, it's hilarious, but it is hilarious not because of any single line you deliver, but because over the course of the testimony, you are reading in sequence for kind of a really long time.
Right.
Text message after text message after embarrassing text message. You're describing the emojis and demanding that the guy on trial do the faces.
Right,
that,
right. Yes, you know? Yes, yeah.
And there is something about the pacing and the facial expression and the way you channel when you're reading a text, this sort of every bro kind of voice.
Sure.
Can you talk about what it is you're channeling there? Because it's very subtle, and it's more subtle than if you were delivering, like, the line or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I probably could if I know the sketch you're talking about with Eli Manning. And, yeah, he's a guy who is accused of murder, but we prove that it couldn't have been him. But his alibi are all these late night booty texts, you know, and we were very, I would applaud us on the opposite side of things, you know, the way the sausage is made on the comedy tip, that we gave an NFL quarterback one word answers, because, you know, Eli and Peyton, while both great guys and great quarterbacks, they're, when it comes to comedy, they're really good quarterbacks, and Eli probably more so than Peyton. Peyton's got a good knack for the jokes, but I don't know. I think anything that I'm doing is by proxy of sort of what we were talking about that I lost my train of thought of just being surrounded by funny people my whole life, always being drawn to it, having funny parents, funny relatives. I was always drawn to people that made me laugh. It's lovely to make other people laugh, especially people that make me laugh. And I was just, you know, I'm the byproduct of having so many funny friends, Billy being one of them, and just trying to keep up. And so like that, I'm probably channeling, you know, who knows, Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird. I probably could, you know, draw a line to it if I watched it myself, but I don't really watch myself, but I can go back into that moment and I know that sketch. But yeah, I think I also, my father raised me not so much with like telling me these things, but just what he responded to whenever we'd watch a movie. And if there was a bad guy or a bully or, you know, someone hypocritical, someone that was obnoxious, someone that was rude, he just had a disdain for them, both in films or television, you know, whoever the bad guy was and the arrogant guy was. And then certainly in real life, he never talked trash about them, but he didn't keep company with people like that. And he sort of just intuitively knew that. And so I find those people inherently disturbing and also comical from a distance. I don't like it when they are in places of power, like some of them are these days, if you want my personal opinion. But like, because I think it sets a bad example, and it does. It lowers the bar and it raises a different bar for just, you know, indecency. But so I don't mind embodying those people because of my dislike of them. But I also try to empathize with them as an actor, to, you know, play their pain and make them a little bit more human than maybe they allow themselves to be when they're doing their you know, real world shenanigans.
So. Billy, what is your favorite Jason Sudeikis role as an old friend, just watching him in his career? Do you have a favorite role or a favorite moment?
There are three that come to mind immediately, so I'll just say those. Four, actually.
Wow.
So the John Bovey is really great with him in Forte, which we're going to have a taste of at Thunder Gong. I did last year.
That's a Bon Jovi opposite cover band. They sing the opposite lyrics of Bon Jovi because they hate Bon Jovi so much that they're like, let's create a band that's the exact opposite of it. And so that's John Bovey. So they, instead of singing Wanted, Dead, and Alive, they sing Unwanted,
alive or dead.
Or dead.
Yeah. So. Jason and Will are obviously great together and have so many great things. But a couple of there's where he was the strip club MC.
Sure. Yeah.
Which, yeah. I really enjoyed that.
Loosely based on a few errant trips to Shady Lady and Bazookas.
Sure.
But that's
sure.
A guy that talked like this. That, yeah. You know, they say, hey, fellas, how you doing? We got, you know, 3-for-1 shrimp. From the 3-for-1 yesterday shrimp.
Watch out for the. Yeah. And then it was, I believe Helen Mirren was the host, and I can't remember what. He's like, she's been backstage snorting Boniva.
Yeah. So
that was, I really loved that one. And then I believe his name is Vance, the dancer from What Up With That.
I believe that
is really, really great. And then also the.
Just one more favorite.
One more favorite. Yeah, I'm going to go on, but I'll give you one more. The guy from the potato chip.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that which was a, yeah.
Also, courtroom, right?
Main Justice, potato chip, yeah. Google, you can Google those. Yeah. They exist out there.
I got a lot of them.
Jason Sudeikis, Billy Brimblecom Jr., thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having
thanks
us.
Thanks for having us.
Thunder Gong at the Uptown tomorrow night is a fundraiser for Billy's company, the Steps of Faith Foundation, supporting amputees and their needs for prosthetic limbs. Up next, what would you put in a Kansas City time capsule to be opened 100 years from now? Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. A couple years ago, they were tearing down an old school building in Kansas City, and they found a time capsule that had been buried more than 100 years earlier. There was a ceremonious unveiling of the capsule and its contents, which are now part of the Kansas City Museum's collections. A 100-year-old time capsule is a very exciting thing to find, but a local artist is taking it one step further, inspired by the contents and what they say about Kansas City in the year 1900. Or thereabouts, she is imagining what objects and moments and spaces in our community would tell people something in the future about life here in 2018. Renee Sinderhaus, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So explain your project.
I started working with Anna Marie Tutera, who's the director of the Kansas City Museum, about a couple years ago. She has spearheaded the renovation of Corinthian Hall and envisioned a whole new identity for the Kansas City Museum. And she is really proactive in working with the arts and artists of Kansas City and National Arts. And we started talking about using this moment of this historic restoration as sort of a prime opportunity to make a specific collaboration. The project has evolved quite a bit, and basically we were interested in inserting original pieces of art into the restoration process so that it wouldn't just sort of be this closed entity the entire time under the years that it was going to take to rebuild and reopen. So we've gotten to the point where I suggested that I put things in the walls. The house was originally built in 1910 by R.A. Long as a family home, and it's gone through many, many different chapters of history since. So
you're putting things in the walls of the museum.
Correct.
That will or won't be found at a later date.
That's an interesting conversation. It's still unfolding. I am documenting all of the contents. There is one capsule per floor. There are going to be four floors when it's reopened. And each floor has a very specific identity within the museum's visitor experience plan and sort of their narrative content. I was pretty impressed. I've lived in Kansas City for upwards of 20 years now, and I had no idea the extent of their permanent collection and archives. And I got to tour quite a bit of it and see a lot of the artifacts that haven't been viewed by the public in a long time, since they've been closed for a while. So a lot of those objects really worked as impetus and inspiration for me when considering the layered history that's already sort of encapsulated in this building, and then seizing an opportunity to add my story as well.
So tell me about an object from another time period that you saw that really like took you to some other reality, another kind of experience of Kansas City than the one you have in 2018.
Well, I kind of look at a lot of objects that way. Context gives meaning. It's the stories in our objects and in our relationships that really provide meaning to lives. And so it can be as simple as finding somebody's comb that had been accidentally dropped down that crack in the floorboards, or, you know, even something with a bit more intent. A lot of times, those that used to build buildings centuries ago would leave a bottle of whiskey or a pack of smokes or a quick snapshot of who they were or what they were doing at the time. And it's kind of like a handshake and hello to somebody that you'll never meet because they're not even born yet. And it just adds to the idea that we're all part of this ongoing conversation.
Can you tell me about an object that you are really excited to hide in the walls of the Kansas City Museum?
Well, it's okay. These capsules that I'm making are art capsules. So they're a good bit different than the traditional idea of a time capsule, where I am curating cultural ephemera, both historic ephemera and contemporary ephemera, and I'm working within specific themes. So I tried to pick themes that I felt identified conversations that we've been having for generations culturally, not just regionally, but nationally, globally, these important conversations as humans that identify us and define us. And so I had to think about how to craft original pieces of art within these themes that also created a bigger narrative with the cultural artifacts I was crafting and collecting. So with the idea of the bottle of whiskey, for instance, I approached the Rieger Distillery in the East Bottoms, and they are now run by descendants of the original J. Rieger, who operated in Kansas City near the stockyards back before Prohibition. And they've now become a very well-known distillery again, and they have crafted alcohol from pre-Prohibition era type recipes, working with some master distillers, and they donated a bottle of their whiskey, and I got the co-founders to sign the bottle. And then I also made these custom whiskey glasses that were based off of some of the original bottle designs back around 1910 or so.
What did they look like?
Well, that's kind of a secret.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, some of the documentation of what's in the time capsules will only be released. Like, I'm trying to choose signature pieces to talk about the contents of each capsule so that people sort of get a it's like a sneak peek. It's a little tiny piece. It's something that's used as a springboard for the stories that are inside. But so much of what is interesting about a time capsule is not knowing exactly what's in it. Then you take the mystery away. So,
ooh, okay. So the Rieger is an interesting example of something where, like, the story of the company itself is really a conversation between generations, that it had one kind of life, this company, before Prohibition. Prohibition, like, changed everything. And then there's something about our own time period, not just the story of the Rieger family, but also the story of our time period that would bring a local distiller back into business on some level. So there's this sort of generational arc to the story of this company that has human characters in it, and it has the personality of different eras in it and the politics of different eras in it. And I've heard you describe a lot of your projects as a call and response between generations. Can you talk about what that means to you?
Absolutely. We are all part of an ongoing conversation. This is a conversation we're having with every generation that's come before us. Without what has been built by those that came before us, we would not be who we are today, either as individuals or as a culture. And we're actively doing that right now, building towards a future. So I think it's important for all of us to be conscious of the larger conversations we're having culturally and understand that even though it's hard to feel heard and an individual's voice heard within all that, that we have a responsibility to speak up and shape that conversation.
Well, so how do you see your own surroundings through the eyes of someone in the future? Is that part of, like, a way that you are now looking at your surroundings, thinking about this project?
That kind of ties a little into some of the themes I kind of honed in on. For instance, environmental legacy is one of the themes. Personal freedom is one of the themes. I tried to choose things that are not only very relevant now, but again, there are timeless conversations that we've had going back centuries that we collectively share these things that we all have to somewhat agree on or at least keep discussing to decide how we're going to move forward, not only as individuals, but like globally. Trying to pick things that are timeless, that these ongoing conversations will still be having in 100, 200, 300 years from now if we're still around to have those conversations.
Yes. Can you tell me about another object that you're really excited about putting there in the walls in your sort of unconventional time capsule of that combines created objects and objects just of the world?
Well, tying into the, personal freedoms idea and within the Rieger context, I actually was able to source an original medicinal liquor prescription from 1925, from the Prohibition era. And that was one of the more interesting original cultural artifacts that I was able to put in context, specifically right now in relation to a lot of conversations we're having nationally about the legalization of marijuana. It seems to be a callback to the Prohibition era as well. And sometimes my time capsules are sort of vessels within vessels. I cast one of my arms in porcelain, and it's hollow. So I also made DNA packets so that it's my genetic fingerprint inside this arm. And it is layered with imagery about genealogy and bloodlines.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman here with artist Renee Sinderhaus, and you can call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the object or image that you think would be compelling for Kansas Cityans generations from now, looking back at our lives. 816-235-2888. We really want your ideas, so call us up or tweet us at KCURCST. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking to Renee Sinderhaus about Witness, her project with the Kansas City Museum. And Renee, why don't you sort of re-summarize this project for our listeners?
Thanks, Gina. I am making four art time capsules for the Kansas City Museum to be enclosed within the walls of Corinthian Hall, one per floor. And these capsules are thematic both to our current cultural conversations and to the content of the museum's exhibition design.
So, okay, we've been talking about some of the different things that you're folding into some of these time capsules and some of what the themes are. But tell me about the word witness.
that has been sort of an ongoing working title for the larger project that's still underway. So these time capsules are just sort of stage one of a bigger project. The second part will be geared towards the museum's reopening, where I am working on larger sculptures that incorporate some materials that were salvaged from the demolition process of Corinthian Hall, which is sort of an exciting secondary project. When I was thinking about witness, I was thinking about it within the phrase of bearing witness to something and what that means. And it means attesting to the truth of something, bearing witness literally to witness something happening gives it a validity that it doesn't have both legally and emotionally for people. Humanity's the consciousness of the universe. We have this responsibility to record and remember. And I think it's especially important for everyone to feel like they have a voice within our cultural conversations. So your singular perspective, you witness every day. But giving witness to somebody else validates more of our stories.
Is there something that you have thought about putting into one of these time capsules that is about witnessing not your own story of Kansas City or your own story of what it is to be a person walking around here in 2018, but somebody else's?
Some of the objects that I'm putting in the time capsule are historic postcards. And a lot of these postcards I did try and source from roughly around 1900 through the 1920s, around the time that Corinthian Hall was originally built in 1910. Some are actually postmarked in 1910. And as much as possible, I tried to source these postcards from Kansas City. And a lot of these, especially the ones that have been stamped and canceled, were sent. I mean, this is correspondence clearly well prior to any digital age. So a lot of times these postcards were almost like the text message you'd send when you'd arrive on the train. Somebody just saying hello and that they've landed or what they're doing for their day or where they went.
It'll just take a little longer to arrive.
Exactly. And working with these historic postcards, sometimes I, instead of rewriting them or writing over them, I added to their conversation. So I would select parts of what they had written and reweave it into a new narrative with a few things of my own. So now, and then I'd have them, I had them canceled again at the main post office in Union Station. So a lot of these are double stamped. I got historic stamps. And, you know, it's, again, we write, rewrite, and write history, and we're writing on top of each other, whether we're erasing something that somebody said before us, just trying to talk louder than them, or actually weave our story into theirs, is, you know, exactly the finer lines of everything of history, really. So
this moment when the time capsules will be put in the walls, it's not the things in these capsules, they're not just about today. They're about today as connected to all the eras that came before.
Exactly. And how we're shaping one larger conversation that will take us into the future.
Is there something that since you started this project, something in your just day-to-day surroundings that you have looked at differently because of your mind being sort of transported to this, what this looks like through the eyes of someone maybe walking the same street 100 years ago or 100 years from now?
Yeah, quite a few places, actually. I live in the historic Northeast in Pendleton Heights, and it was originally considered the first suburb of Kansas City after the industrial boom. And a lot of the postcards that I sourced are actually early photo postcards of Independence Avenue, of the Paseo, of an area that's gone through a lot of birth and rebirth in Kansas City's history. And it's interesting to see it within this new chapter of revitalization with the museum's restoration. Also, things like the convergence of the Missouri and Kaw Rivers, Kaw Point River Park, historically in terms of it being a major trading post. And now there are people who live in Kansas City who have never even stepped foot there. And it's interesting things, seeing things through the lens of so many layers, really.
What will be the opportunity for Kansas Cityans to see some hint of what's in your time capsules?
Well, that will be an ongoing unveiling. I am working with the Kansas City Museum to select these signature pieces that will then be shown to the public. Also, when the museum reopens, there will be a way to see if you can come find where I hid them all.
Ooh, really?
Yeah.
A little hide and seek for time capsules?
A little bit, yeah. So I kind of hope that that will be an interesting challenge specifically for kids. Come and see if you can find the secrets in the walls.
Renee Cinderhouse, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gina.
Renee Cinderhouse is the artist behind Witness. And before we go, Mexican communities all over the world will celebrate Dia de los Muertos this weekend. And Kansas City is definitely no exception. Families will gather to honor loved ones who have died and to help them along their spiritual journey. One community in Kansas City, Kansas, is taking this as an opportunity to bring the whole city together with a parade. KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez has the story.
The idea for Mexico City's very first Dia de los Muertos parade came from a 2015 James Bond movie. In the opening scene of Spectre, Daniel Craig weaves through a massive Day of the Dead parade in Mexico City in pursuit of his target. The next year, Mexican officials made it a reality.
And it really created an impact that today, several places have taken this idea.
Edgar Galicia is with the Central Avenue Betterment Association. He took the idea to Kansas City, Kansas, and launched the first Day of the Dead parade down Central Avenue last year. It was such a success, participation has more than doubled. Danny Gonzalez is leading a group of 20 volunteers to paint people's faces like calaveras, the colorful decorated skulls that are typical of Day of the Dead celebrations. Sitting at Sabor Centroamericano, a restaurant along the parade route, she said last year's parade allowed her to share her culture with strangers.
Some people would even ask us about it. Like, while I was painting faces, they'd be like, can you explain why, you know, we paint the faces?
The answer to that for Gonzalez is about creating a physical connection with loved ones that have already passed away.
You have to, like, accept that death is kind of a part of your life.
That comfortable, intimate relationship with death is what attracts Jessica Riviera to Day of the Dead. She's from El Salvador and was used to a darker, ominous image of death.
When you say la muerte, it's like you imagine the guy with the big thing, the sharpie thing.
The Grim Reaper?
Yes, yeah. And then all covered in black and with a big old ugly face. It's scary.
Riviera is drawn to the Mexican depiction, the elegant Katrina, the tall lady skeleton in a big hat decked out in marigolds and rich colors. Her Katrina was such a hit last year, she's organizing more than a dozen Katrinas that will mill around the crowds. A few of them gathered on a recent Thursday to practice their makeup and hand out flyers at a zombie Zumba event. Natalie Martinez-Vowell said in Colombia, where she's from, they don't celebrate Dia de los Muertos, but here she feels like part of the tradition.
No, it's for the greater community. And I think it's about learning about what these celebrations are. And by being part, you can also see more beyond the dress up, the sugar skulls.
Megan Painter, another Katrina this year, said all kinds of people line up on the parade route.
It doesn't matter who you are, you're going to line up for candy and you're going to see things that you've not seen before. And, you know, KCK doesn't have a majority, and so it's a beautiful mix of minority, and I think that's probably why we have so many celebrations.
Kansas City, Kansas has a lot of parades during the year. Aside from the Dia de los Muertos parade, there's a Silver City parade, a Central Avenue parade, a Polski Day parade, and Cinco de Mayo, each celebrating a different culture within the city. Edgar Galicia, the man behind the Day of the Dead parade, says these celebrations show the rest of the metro, the vibrant community that lives here, because KCK hasn't always been a destination.
Wyandotte County, Kansas City, Kansas in specific, has gone through an evolution. Yes, we had hard times. Yes, we had a lot of crime. Yes, we had challenges with government and politics.
Galicia believes that just having people line Central Avenue, a street they might otherwise avoid, can begin to change that perspective.
The craziest part of it is that we ourselves hold a deeper negative opinion of ourselves than the rest of the people. So we need to reverse that, and these type of events help us do that.
Galicia is especially proud of this celebration because, unlike other Dia de los Muertos celebrations across the city that are well-funded, this one is the product of a community volunteering its time and energy. And this time around, the Dia de los Muertos celebration got another boost from the big screen with the movie Coco. Galicia says he's happy that people from all over can share this part of his culture.
That was KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez reporting from KCK, where that Dia de los Muertos celebration is right around the corner. It's tomorrow at 3, and the parade starts at 6 on 7th and Central. Other Dia de los Muertos festivals are also happening around town. There's stuff going on at Mattie Rhodes tonight on the west side and at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art on Sunday, so plan your weekend accordingly. And that's a wrap for today's show and for the week. Everything you've heard or missed will be archived at kcur.org/centralstandard. And did you know you can subscribe to have these conversations sent to your phone like a podcast? kcur.org/centralstandard is where you sign up. Be sure and check out a show we did earlier this week on how to prepare to vote. Election Day is Tuesday, so this weekend is definitely crunch time and kind of last chance to make use of some of those tips. You can also talk to us on Twitter any time. We are at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Chris Young, Coy Duggar, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Jean-Vieve Desmarteaux, Michael Byers, Steven Steigman, and others have been helping to run the board for us this week. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.